Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2725. That's 2725. Tonight we're going to have a young lady on, and I've spoken to her quite a few times before the show, and she's going to be telling her story, okay? And this is her very first time on air, and I just know that she's going to do a fine job. So, you know, and asking people, you know, call in. I see that John is here also. That's good. And let's help support her. I was telling her that we're all survivors, which we are, and there is nothing that hasn't happened to us, so we understand, okay? So anyway, she's probably taking a nice deep breath now, and I want to, her name is Annie Handy Prater. Is that how you say it, Prater?
Yes, ma'am.
I think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she's from Tampa, Florida. And she, too, just like myself, was abused by her older brother. And it was started at age 7, okay? And my abuse was incest, rape, and there was some torture as well. Now, I don't like reading past that because, you know, I want people to tell their story. But before we do that, I will read the mission statement and get that out of the way. And then we'll start in with your story, okay? Okay. We have a singleness of purpose at NASCA, and that is to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so two different ways. Number one is educating the public, especially as related as to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic. It is a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. Number two is offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, which I'm very heavy on, intervention, and recovery. Now, that's just a little tiny bit of what NASCA does. Our website is naasca.org. That's nasca.org, okay? And you'll find a wealth of information right on that NASCA website. I use it all the time. And sometimes I go a little outside of it, but that's primary. 95% of the time, everything is coming right off of our NASCA website. So anyway, tonight we have this wonderful guest. I want to give out the telephone number, too. It's 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. And she is looking for a friend that is going to be calling in. I believe it's a friend of hers. And it's the 816 area code. Okay, so if you see that, Bill, maybe you'll, you know, bring that person on. And she'll be here, or he will be here, whichever, to support her. Okay, so with that all out of the way, we're ready for you. And what we do, and I will go over this again, you know, throughout the course of the story, I'll ask you to stop because maybe the panel have a question to ask or maybe make a comment. A lot of times there's a identification. People identify with I already identified one thing with you. I had a brother was abusive also. and many others, but I had a brother too, so I know where you're coming from. And but I will do that two, maybe three times if I see fit throughout the course of the show. And then after you tell your story, we ask what you're doing today, okay? And then your show will be over, and you'll just be so happy that you're here. Yes, you will. You'll see. Okay, Annie. Why don't you, you know, start out from the earliest remembrance that you have, the memories that you have of when the abuse started. Go ahead.
Okay. Best guess age-wise, so my brother is about 2.5 years older than I am. The first time that I remember anything, I was somewhere around 7 years old. It was, to me, kind of minor, but I have some other things that are a lot more major. However, at the time, it was my mom, my dad, my brother, and myself. We lived in Indiana, what I would consider a normal, happy family. Until one day, we were out back playing, and we had a treehouse that we adored. And I remember being up there one day, just kind of looking out the window and just enjoying the sunshine. And, you know, someone had just mowed their grass. It was beautiful outside. And he kind of came in, and I didn't really realize he came in. I think I was just so lost in my thoughts and myself. That he kind of came up behind me, and he said, "Hey, do you want to try something?" And I didn't say anything. And so he said, "I want to try to pee through you." And again, I didn't say anything. I don't think I knew what that even meant. And next thing I know, he's spinning me around to this. There was a little square table in the middle where the tree stump was. Like, my dad had cut part of it off and made a little table so we could have picnics and all that fun stuff up there. So the next thing I know, he spins me around to face this table, pulls down my shorts and my underwear, and just, like, bends me over. Again, I didn't say anything. I didn't know I should say something. It was pretty silent. And then I could feel the tip of his penis go into my butt. Why my butt? I do not know. And then next thing I know, he pees. I don't remember it hurting. I just remember feeling the warmth of him, like, peeing on me. And then as quick as it started, it was over. I remember not moving and him, like, I remember watching him leave the treehouse. I don't remember getting dressed, but obviously I didn't stand up there like that for hours. You know, and I remember, like, going back to the window and staring out the window for forever, it felt like. I do also remember, like, looking at the table and seeing, like, a little puddle of pee, and I legit thought for years that he was successful, that he had actually peed through me. Obviously, now I know anatomy does not work that way. So really, that's the first one. So I was about 7-ish. He was somewhere around 9.5, 10. When that happened, we never talked about it. I don't remember the rest of the day. It was just kind of something that happened, and I don't know. I'd never really even thought about it for the most part. Mm-hmm. That's number one. After that, it comes more in, like, sets of memories. I remember specific places we were at where those incidents happened. So shortly after the first time, my parents got a divorce, and my mom stayed single for quite some time. She dated, but nobody moved in, kind of thing. My dad ended up moving in with his mom and dad until he could save up and, you know, get back out there.
Right.
So when we would go to dad's, dad was grandma and grandpa's house, which we loved, we adored. So it, you know, it didn't seem like an issue. I think where the problem came in is we shared a bed. They only had a 2-bedroom house. So they got one bedroom. My dad worked third shift, so he was gone. So we slept in what was his bed. And that's kind of where all the problems really started. I don't remember, like, the first time, the first incident at their house. It's all a mix of memories. Mm-hmm. But just to give you an idea, the bedrooms were on the second floor. The bedrooms were super, super close together. They actually shared a closet. The headboard of the bed was actually against the door to the closet. And it was made up of, like, little bars, and so was the footboard. And I remember, like, I slept in a nightgown back then, or, like, a daddy T-shirt, you know, because I thought it was the coolest thing to wear his clothes. My brother just slept in shorts. Like, no shirt, no nothing. So we would go to bed. You know, Dad would come tuck us in and tell us he loved us, and he'd go downstairs and get ready to go to work. Grandma hung out downstairs. My grandpa actually worked the shift before my dad. So Grandpa would get home a little after Dad was supposed to be at work. Like, he kind of took Grandpa's place. So she would just wait up for him, basically. Never came upstairs to check on anything. You know, we were a little bit older, like probably 8 and 10, 8 and 11, when it first started. So you think that age, and you're told to go to sleep, you go to sleep. Typically, those nights started out as like a truth or dare. And they would start out super silly and like stupid things, like lick the window or... Well, I don't know, lick the carpet. You know, just silly things that kids mm-hmm. say to kids. But then it just became so much more than that. You know, then it was hump the floor. Then it was, even like, it was never necessarily like doing stuff to each other. That came later. But it was always like he would make me do something so that he could watch is more or less what was happening. I was not allowed to pick truth, so it was more like we played dare. After picking truth a couple times, I guess that just wasn't an option anymore. So most of the time it started out that way. There were nights that I would pretend I was asleep. Or there were nights that I would even say, hey, I'm super tired, you know, like, can we do it tomorrow? Like, I'll do it tomorrow. Can we skip tonight, you know? So there were those nights. There were nights that there was no conversation and he just started. But generally it was dare. And then it would just lead into either him asking me to take my clothes off or him just doing it himself. So he didn't have a lot to take off, so he would do that. There were times I remember him taking my nightgown. And he would do one of two things. He would either tie me up, like tie my hands to the railings above my head, those little bars. He would mm-hmm. do that, or he would take it and he would shove it underneath the covers all the way, like, down to the foot of the bed. I'm not really sure what the purpose of that was, but that's what happened. And the thing is, we always knew when they were coming upstairs. Their stairs were so loud, you could hear it creak from probably a mile away. So obviously, mm-hmm. as soon as you hear that, the expectation was you pull the covers up as far as you can and you pretend like you're asleep. That way, on the off chance that they peek in at us, we're sleeping, right? Mm-hmm. Which I don't recall them ever peeking in, but it was the just-in-case measure that he put in place. So after we were naked, I was tied up or not tied up. It just depended on his mood, I guess, or how willing or unwilling I was that night. And then he usually would get on top of me, and he would he forced his tongue in my mouth, I don't know how many times. And if I didn't kiss back, you know, then there was a problem there. But he would kind of start there, and then he would just go down. And sometimes he'd come back up, you know, and play with my boobs, and which I didn't really have. I mean, at that point, they were, you know, I was like 8 years old, and I did gymnastics. So, I mean, I didn't get boobs until, like, sixth or seventh grade. They were really not existent. It was invisible. But he'd play with those, touch them, lick them, I mean, all the things. And then he'd move down. A lot of times it would start with his fingers. And I remember that being painful. And I was super confused. But I always thought it was normal. Just this is what happened. Everybody does this, right? It wasn't until, like, middle school that I realized that that's not true. However, there's a lot of fingering, and I don't remember the very first time that there was actual intercourse. I do know that it, or rape, it wasn't, I guess, intercourse, because I was not willing in any way, shape, or form. I do know most every time was painful. I don't remember a lot of times where it wasn't, I mean, even into our teens, you know, like, it was just awful. So I would watch, there was a lava lamp on the desk across the room. There's also a barometer over there, and a fiber optic flower or something. And I just would watch those things, you know, especially the lava lamp. I would wait, you know, and watch and try to guess when the next clump was going to move to the top. And then when that one did, I'd focus on another, you know. This was pretty much any time we were at Dad's. I'm sure that there were some nights that we were visiting Dad that nothing happened. I just know majority of the time he knew he had as much time as he wanted. As soon as they went to bed, like, that was it. There was no anything until Dad got home at 7 o'clock the next morning or whatever. Mm-hmm. So this went on. I have talked to my dad a little bit about time frames and things, and a good two and a half years. So we shared a bed that entire time.
Jeez.
I don't understand.
Yeah.
But we did when we were at Dad's. That's what happened. So those are all, like, mixed together. There was also forms of punishment. So, and it really didn't matter if I performed to his liking or not. There were definitely times it was worse when I was disobedient or pretended like I didn't hear him. You know, those things. Typically, punishment was worse. So one of his favorite things, besides making me give him a blowjob, his favorite thing was he would take, and we usually had a cup of water or something up there for the night, and he would take the cup and either drink everything in it or pour it out, and then he would take the open part and put it kind of centered on my stomach. Like around my belly button area. And then he would usually get on top of me and push. I got to the point where I learned not to say ow or not to react, the best that I could anyway, because, you know, if I was like, ow, you know, then we push harder. I guess for speaking up, I don't really know. So that started, which later became an issue of self-harm for me. But that was pretty frequent as well. Or if he didn't feel like doing any work, then he would have me go lay it on the floor with the open side up, and then I would have to get on top of it. There were times I remember him coming over and, like, putting his foot on me and, like, pushing. I mean, those are really kind of the biggest points from that section of life. Like I said, it was a good 2.5 years. I thought it was normal. I never questioned anything. I never once thought about, you know, my grandparents were 10 footsteps away from the room I was in, but never once did I ever consider talking to them or telling them or screaming. I never thought about it. And even if I did, I wouldn't have done it because I knew better. Everything had a consequence. And he typically picked the things that I hated the most.
Not nice. Hold on a second, honey. We have a 931 area code here. Take a deep breath. You're doing a fine job. I just want you to know that.
Thank you.
Doing a fine job. This is very hard, very difficult. Most of us have all been through this, and it's very hard. I know this. 931 area code, who am I speaking to?
You don't know my number, sis.
Oh, God's sake, I should know this, shouldn't I? Okay. This is Darlene. Oh, my God. Well, I don't get a star today, do I? No, I don't. Oh, my God.
You still get a star regardless. Yes, you do.
Ah, thank you, sweetie.
You
okay. All right. Darlene is one of our NASCA members, and she's here to support you. I don't know if you have heard any of this, but I can tell you that, you know, it's the brother, and also, too, he's a nasty brother. He reminds me of my brother, to be honest with you. But anyway, she's telling her story. And she's doing a fine job. And this is the first time she's ever been on air, okay? Her name is Annie Handy Prater. And we have Darlene here. So Darlene is ambassador, and she's all kinds of different things and works in all different kinds of groups. And so we're very happy to have her on the show. So anyway, boy, I just want to punch
him. Take a deep breath.
You know, take a deep breath. But, you know, I'm listening to this story. I'm listening to this story, and he reminds me of my brother, okay? And I want to punch him. I can't help it. That's what I feel like doing because he is hurtful. Yeah, I do. I want to give him a punch, and I can't. I don't even know who he is. Go ahead. I wanted to punch my brother, too. Go ahead. So,
I can give you a charger. I'm just kidding.
Oh, well, that'd be fine. I'll go do it just for you. Let me tell you what. We've been through this, many of us, you know, and but every time you hear it, it just makes you mad. You know what I'm saying? I do. I get mad, too. I'm going to go through the panel now. Remember, this is one time, so I'm going to stop. So you can take a deep breath Again, you're doing a fine job. This is a hard story. A lot of our stories are hard. There's never any good child abuse, okay? So, you know, but you're doing fine. All right, our founder is here. This is Bill from California. Bill, is there something you'd like to say to her?
Mm-hmm. No, just want to say, like you did, that she's doing a great job, you know. You don't have to worry about the people that are here. We're all survivors, too, and we all told our story before. We're identifying with what you went through. Even though I'm a man, for example, I still face similar issues with my predator and so forth. And the reason we tell our stories is to impress on newcomers who might be listening that they don't have to be alone either. Just like you're learning now, you know, you belong to the NASCA family. Well, so do they. When we don't ask much of them. We just want them to come back, you know, or check out the website or whatever. You know, I'm sure they'll find an awful lot that NASCA has to offer them, and they'll engage with us. So I really appreciate you being here. And, Carol, you're doing a great job with her. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Oh, yeah, you bet. Let's go down to John. He's here. This is John Anderson. And he's newer to NASCA. Mm-hmm. But he certainly has a fine voice. Yes, he does. And he knows what to say and all kinds of stuff. So I'm going to bring him on, okay? John, go ahead. The floor is yours. Go ahead.
Hi, Annie. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Great, great. I'm glad you came on tonight, and I want to thank you for telling your story tonight, too, by the way, because, you know, I think one of the main things with all this is about our education, you know, and you're doing a great job of that, of just coming out tonight alone, you know. You know, and I've been through everything on your bio and everything, and I just can't wait to hear a lot of the rest of your story and you know, and what you have in your future, you know, that I see, you know, that I'm really proud of you for wanting to, you know, go toward the Senate and all that stuff. So I just got finished with all of that, and we got the statute of limitations totally removed here in Louisiana now. So it took me a long time, you know, to get to that point, and it takes a lot of patience, and it's just really getting through to the right people, you know. So later on, yeah, you know, if I can ever help you with anything with that, I'm definitely down, you know, for helping you any way I can, you know. And I do want to say that you're very brave for coming on tonight, and just be yourself, and everybody here is supporting you 100%, okay?
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Okay.
Yeah, you bet. You bet. Thank you for that, John. So I want to ask you something. At what age,
yeah,
I think you said middle school, when did you realize that this wasn't right? Okay. What age were you? I'm curious.
I want to say honestly that it was 7th or 8th grade. So that would put me, I'm terrible with figuring out the math of the years,
mm-hmm.
What age I would have been.
About 13.
I was 15 going into high school, so somewhere around, sounds right.
Yeah.
Honestly, that's when I first realized, and I think it was because I spent a lot of time with one of my friends from gymnastics.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up, I was over at her house a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't happen. You know, like, I never heard anybody talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I really started to come to the conclusion that it wasn't normal and that things that were happening in my house shouldn't be happening.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That's good. Okay. So at any point did you try to, you know, like tell your mother or your father or something, you know, what he was doing?
No.
Or were you too frightened?
I like I said, I'll kind of get to where I did tell later.
Mm-hmm.
But during all of the abuse, which was total about 7 years, no, I don't remember even thinking about telling. I remember hoping that he would get caught red-handed, but never of going and telling someone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of kids that don't tell, okay? So many do, and then there's so many that don't. And but you certainly have a lot more to your story yet, and a lot more is going to come out about what you tried to do, which is what John was talking about, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot to talk about yet. And so I'm just thankful that you're here. And you know what? Again, like I said, when this is all over with tonight, you're going to feel really good about what you did because you're helping people right now. There are people that are listening in. And I'm going to get the number out again. A lot of them don't want to come in and go on the panel. Hold on a second. But I'm going to give it anyway. 646-595-2118 has 646-595-2118. Okay, you can call in. You can ask your own questions. There you go. Okay.
Yeah.
So, right. And you know what? When you're done with all of this, you can come back anytime you want, okay, Monday through Friday, and you can be on the panel, and you can ask people questions, okay, or make comments, okay?
Yeah.
Just letting you know that, yeah. So you'd be a family member then. So that's what our family members do. I mean, John is here, Darlene's here, and of course Bill and I are here, and you know, whoever else is going to call in. Maybe your 816 will be calling in soon. But anyway, all right. Let's get back to your story, and let's see. I got mad. I felt like punching him. I remember saying that. Go ahead. Go from that point on.
Okay, so there's some of this that overlaps a little bit. So I grouped them age-wise, but they will overlap, and I'll get to that. After my dad moved out, got his own place, we obviously still went and spent time with dad, say that it was not as severe. He was still digitally penetrating me, but it wasn't. That's very different. To me, it was almost like I got this couple years of a break, you know. And it was only when we were both at dad's, so the conditions had to be right, too, for us both to be there. And, you know, like dad had a trailer, and his room was on the opposite side of the trailer as our rooms, creating opportunity. So that, I don't have a lot to say about that time frame. It was really just digital penetration. And then he still used the punishment. But by this point in life, honestly, I had kind of taken that on myself. If I felt I did anything that deserved any sort of punishment, you know, if I made a B minus on the test, you know, to me that wasn't acceptable. So then I would use that method as punishment for myself. Or if I said something I felt I shouldn't have said, or if I felt stupid, if I felt a certain way, that was my go-to. So also, kind of overlapping in this time frame, somewhere between like age 10 to 15, my mom, dad, and stepmom had moved to Tennessee. So we spent summers, spring break, holidays down there. Like, we would go visit, and then we could have, we didn't have a lot of money growing up, so we had rent-free, and we didn't have to really pay for food. We had to pay for the gas to get there and to get home, essentially, was it. So we could go shopping, and we could go hiking and all the fun things, except it wasn't as fun for me as it probably was for everybody else. They settled down on, I don't know how many acres of land, but several. And Grandpa keeps it pretty well maintained. They have all these paths back there. And as kids, you know, we used to go out there and we'd play in the woods for hours, you know. And you didn't come back until they were like, hey, dinner. They'd ring the dinner bell, you know, and then you knew you needed to go inside and clean up and get ready to eat, you know. I mean, hours. Mm-hmm. So for us, he liked to make things a game, and I think it was because he could hook me that way, and I didn't ask questions.
Right.
I've always liked games, board games, card games, scavenger hunts, like you hide and seek, sardines, like you name it. I was about that. Ditches. I loved it. So I think that was kind of his way of, like, hooking me. Of course, I didn't know that at the time, but. So this would start out as a game as well, and it was kind of like I was I don't even know how to word it. So basically, he would get on my grandpa's John Deere mowing tractor, and then they would hook up a trailer to it. Like I was a travel guide or something, you know, like Barbie. And I would sit right behind the seat, put my feet like where the hitch is, and I'd sit right on the side of that trailer, and I would talk to a pretend audience about, oh, well, now we're coming up on this. And if you look to your right, you know, it's all this game. And then when we would actually, like, really get back into the woods, there was a specific spot that was almost completely encompassed by trees. There was a tiny little entryway. But if you didn't know where it was, you can't just find it, you know? One
right.
of those spaces. So we would play this game, and then eventually we always wound up at this spot. And, I mean, for me at this point, if he said it, there wasn't a lot of questioning. There wasn't a lot of, you know, I've already been through several years with him at this point. It was I'm going to do and hope that maybe I can make it faster. So if he was like, we're getting off, I'll meet you in there, like that's what I did. So we would go into this little spot in the woods, and here it was definitely more about like touching. He did use his fingers, but it was very for him. There wasn't a lot of me touching him or having to do things to him. It was more or less him getting whatever satisfaction out of touching me. So, and it would last, I mean, sometimes it was very brief, you know, be like maybe 10 minutes. Sometimes it would be longer, and I mean, probably a good 30 to 45 minutes. It's so hard to tell time when you're in the middle of stuff like that, to figure out how long things actually take. I do remember there's a couple times, like mom or grandma and grandpa would come out into the woods, and my job while he's doing all of this touching and using his mouth for things, like my job was to keep watch. So if I could tell that they were getting close, it was my job to let him know. So obviously I played into that a little bit, and oh my gosh, I think I see him, you know, like I might get a break. If we really think we see him, then maybe I can sneak out real quick, or maybe he'll be like, all right, we're not going to start over. Sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. But there were a couple times they came in the woods looking for us. And when that happened, he had a plan. He would go out that entrance way, and meet them and talk to them and whatever. And, oh, I don't know where Annie is. She was over there and looking at blah, 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 or whatever. My job was to kind of sneak out somewhere else and then come up and pretend like I'd just been out exploring.
Right.
Thankfully, it only happened
right.
a couple times to where I had to pretend like that. But life was as normal as I could make it, because he terrified me, and I was so scared that he would hurt me worse, because he told me he would do that. He also told me that, you know, when you're young and, you know, people tell you, oh, well, they'll think you're gross, or they won't believe you, or, you know, like, it's super easy to believe those things, especially coming from someone that you're supposed to look up to and trust. So I always, I don't know, I just got to the point where everything was pretty much like, he says jump and I say how high. We're just going to do it and hope that it goes by faster for that day or for that night or whatever.
Right.
So that was summers and vacations with mom for roughly 5 years of the total seven. After that, honestly, this is the worst set of memories for me, and I think it's because I was older and I remember so much more about what happened and how I felt. And I mean, his facial expressions, the things he said. It happened at my mom's house. My mom worked two jobs because she was a single mama, and sometimes that's what you got to do to make ends meet and give your kids food and, you know, all the things. I don't want to fault her for that part. So I was about 13 when we moved in. I was in middle school. We spent a lot of time together. At this point, I had to quit gymnastics. We could no longer afford for me to go. For most of those years, I started when I was 5. So that was kind of my safe haven, my outlet, all of those things. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it was probably between 6th and 7th grade where that was not an option anymore. So we were home alone, you know, 95% of the time, I'd say, especially in the summers. He wasn't into sports or anything. He's very geeky and into computer games and video games. Spent a lot of time together, unfortunately. And so he had upstairs was our bedroom. Mom's bedroom was downstairs for a little while. It moved later, but that's irrelevant at this point. So you would walk up the stairs, and his room was this big open area. Like, you walk up there to his room. Then you look to the right, and there was a door, which led to my room. And then if you went through that door, through my room, there was another room on the other side of that, which later became his room when he was caught sneaking out. So he went through my room all the time to go to his room. But the important part is, upstairs, he had a bunk bed, and the bottom was a futon, so he could put the mattress wherever he wanted to put it. He never had friends come over. He didn't have a lot of friends, imagine that. So typically, he would just place it on the bottom and use it as a futon, and then when he wanted to sleep, he'd just lay it down. However, it also had rungs. I call them rungs, bars, just like Grandma and Grandpa's bed did. Here, though, things became a lot more advanced. Typically, again, it started out with a game. We played a lot of five-card poker, but it was strip poker. You know, and at first I would try, like, I'm going to slip on an extra sock and maybe he won't notice, you know, or I'm not going to count my undershirt. Like, as girls, guys, I'll tell you right now, as girls, sometimes you got to wear that undershirt so you have the layered look and all this mess. It's a mess. So I would be like, okay, well, my undershirt, like, maybe if I don't say anything, it won't count as a layer, you know. Of course, didn't last very long. I usually ended up without clothes on first. Sometimes he would go ahead and just take the rest of his off. Sometimes he would put everything back on. And almost, like, torment me because he got to be dressed. I will say that was definitely not as often. He typically would go ahead and take whatever else off if he had anything left. And it started a lot of the same way as it did at Grandma and Grandpa's house, kissing, making out, you know, hands going everywhere, mouth traveling everywhere, you know, like, I'll just say it. One of my least favorite things that he used to do is he would start, like, at my neck, and he would just, like, lick me all the way down. It's weird, and I couldn't handle it. One of my least favorite things. So things like that, obviously, I did a lot more for him at this point. Anything that he asked for, I was expected to do. I would say, honestly, the worst part came in. He would get out. He had this humongous roll of duct tape, and he would get it out pretty much every time. There were times it wasn't used at all, but most every time it was used, and my hands were tied up either above my head to the bars above where an extra mattress would be placed, or he had these big, like, almost like armrests on the side of the bed on the bottom bunk, because you could sit up and watch TV as well. So it was one of those things. The one that sticks out to me the most, and one of the ones I have the hardest time with, is the bars above my head. We would do all sorts of things. That was a wonderful way for him to get a blowjob without me stopping to gag or spit or whatever. Then he could just do whatever he wanted at whatever pace. He also would, I mean, it's the things that he would say too. So I'll mention some of that. He always called me a dirty girl, or he'd be like, hey, if you just do what I'm asking you to do, if you just be a good girl, like, it won't be that bad. Like, just do what I ask, you know? Or he would say, he would basically make me tell him that I liked it. A lot of times he would ask and I wouldn't say anything, because I couldn't say the obvious, and I didn't want to give him the satisfaction. But typically, it
was
forced
out. Want your,
let me
stop you for a second, honey. You didn't want your brother, for God's sake, doing all this to you. You would rather have had a boyfriend. I mean, you're getting to the age now. You know, girls are interested in boys, and you want to go to dances, you want to go to parties, you want to have a normal type of life. I have another phone call here that's been sitting here waiting. I didn't want to stop you because I didn't want to stop the flow of your story, but I don't want them to wait any longer. It's 201 area code. Who am I speaking to? 201 area
Hello. Code? Hello. I'm just listening to the story.
You're just listening to the show? Okay. All right.
Yes.
That's fine. Okay, honey. Yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but they've been sitting there for a while. Okay. Okay, go ahead.
That's okay. So one of the times I think this sticks out the most, and this happened more than once, but one of the strongest memories for me is being duct taped to that bed, my hands above my head, naked, and he went downstairs. He would go downstairs, and he would sit, and he would play video games, or he would watch TV, or I don't know what he was doing, and he would just leave me there. And I remember specifically at least one time, probably more than that, him telling me, like, you can sit up here and think about what you did wrong. And I remember, like, you know, racking my brain, trying to think, well, he asked me to do this, and I did. Did I not do it the right way? Maybe I didn't do it enough. You know, like all those questions that run through your head. Like, where did I mess up? I obviously screwed something up, but where's my mistake? I think some of those are the hardest memories for me, because I think I'm broken. Like, something is faulty within myself to make that happen. I know that that's not true.
No,
I do know
it's
that.
Not true. Yes, and you know that now. But you say here, and I have to, you know, I want to read just a little tiny bit for the people who are listening. She had experienced shame, guilt, hopelessness, helplessness, anxiety, worthlessness, weakness, hurt, despair, and most of the time I felt empty/numb, and that's where I come in. I felt empty/numb. I too felt like it was a hopeless situation. Our stories are not exactly the same with the brothers, but still in all, those feelings that I'm speaking about that you have written, that's how people feel, you know? And you guys out there, there's nothing abnormal about feeling like that, because this is what happens. This is what happens, okay? So anyway, I might go to the panel one more time. And because then after that, if we get down further in your story, then we're going to talk about what you're doing today. And I want to hear about the EMDR. We speak about that on the show and how you feel about all this other stuff that you have down here. Let me go to Bill from California. Bill, is there something you'd like to ask or question?
No, I'd just like to hear a little more about pretty much where she is and moving forward. And, you know, she doesn't have to give as much detail at this point. We all get it. But I think there's some things in her later life that didn't involve her brother, with people who abused her as well. And I don't want her to have to skip it because we ran out of time for her. So let's make sure she has enough time before we move too far forward.
Absolutely.
All right? Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. You're doing fine, sweetie. And we get the picture. We get the gist. And I still feel like punching him in the nose. Let me go down here to John, okay, and he can ask a quick question or make a comment, and then to Darlene. Okay, go ahead, John.
Hey, Annie. You're doing a great job tonight, by the way. I did have a question I was wanting to know about. As far as your brother went, I mean, was there some history on his side of anything that you knew of as far as any type of abuse to him, or maybe on that side of the family?
Yes.
There was.
I obviously did not know anything at the time. Some things came out later when I was in therapy. I was in college, and I started asking some questions, and he did admit. We have an uncle who was kind of a serial child molester in our family. So my brother went through I know it was, it seems pretty bad, and it was definitely more than a year. You know, it was, he didn't give me a lot of detail when I asked, but that was kind of what I got. So, and I know what he tried with me, and we have two other cousins that admitted some stuff too. So, yes.
Right. Yeah, because, you know, I hate to say that, but typically sometimes along the line, you know, that seems to be the case a lot of times, you know, and I'm just really sorry that that happened to you at such a young age. It's terrible. It really is. You know, and from what I'm seeing, though, you know, this is going to have a really good outcome, and I know that it will. I can hear it in your voice, and I know where things are leading to, you know, so I want you to continue just telling your story and doing a great job of it, by the way. And anytime I can ever help you, I also have my own organization of SCSA, okay? So we do have women's
okay.
divisions and different things also, okay? And you have
okay,
a good night.
Good.
Okay. Thank
okay,
you.
That's good.
Thank
Let's
you.
Get Darlene on, and then we'll get back to this story here. And we'll find out what she's doing today. And she's fine. You're going to be fine, sweetheart. I'm going to tell you right now, I can tell, okay? Right now, her husband is in the Air Force, and he may be leaving this weekend. Yes, he is, and going overseas. And I thank him for serving our country, and I thank you for coming on this show, for giving us the 90 minutes that you're giving us, because I know it could happen at any moment. All you have to do is watch the TV. I was watching before. And so I thank you for a lot of things. Okay. Now, Darlene, go ahead and ask a question, and then she'll get back to her story, and then we'll get into more of what she's doing today.
Hey, that's interesting because my oldest son is in the Air Force. So my thoughts and prayers are with you during this time. So, you know, it's bad enough. It's difficult. And it's good that you, I guess you got a good marriage.
Yes.
Well, we're
going to
get to that, yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's, you brought up the husband, so I got to still ask, you know. That's
yes.
So, you know, that's good that you, my main question about that was you having support where you're at, you know, daily or wherever you're living, and you're in a safe place at the moment, you know what I'm saying?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that is great that you do have that, and thank you, and you are doing a good job explaining your story and all, and thank you
thank
so
you.
Much for coming in and being brave enough to do that.
Yeah,
thank
this is
you.
Her first time on air.
Yeah,
I think she's
job.
A winner. I think she's a winner.
Oh,
that's what I think. Absolutely.
Let's do it
okay,
too.
Let's go on, yeah. Yeah, you bet.
Okay.
Let's go on, sweetie. Okay, so, you remember where you left off. Let's go from there, and we'll spend a couple minutes on that, and then we'll get into more of what you're doing today. And you're doing a fine job. Go ahead.
So everything kind of stopped. I was about 15 and a half. I was about to start high school, and honestly, it stopped because my mom and I moved to Tennessee to be closer to her dad. Her mom had died when I was in third grade. And my brother did not move. He stayed behind in Indiana with my dad. So it was a winning situation for me. But honestly, for the couple of years, I didn't remember any of this. I couldn't have told you. If you had asked me, I wouldn't have known what to say. At 17... my senior year of high school, I started getting flashbacks, tiny, tiny little pieces, and I ended up telling a teacher at school who told DCS to did an awful, awful, awful job. I worked for DCS for 2 years in Missouri before we came here, and I know what the expectations are, and they were definitely not met. It was just awful. She told me that I had to tell my mom. I had 24 to 48 hours to do it, and if I didn't, the agency was going to do it. So I went home and told mom, freaked out, yelled at me, cussed. Well, she didn't cuss, but she might as well have. But she yelled, called me a liar, told me I was going to tear my family apart. I better get my story straight, you know, X, Y, Z. So So mom became very off limits, which she kind of was growing up anyway. So I didn't really, nothing ever happened with that. DCS never went to the police. They never spoke. They never even spoke to my mom. Problem. It's a problem. They failed really, really bad. So then, you know, I went out to college. I majored in psychology. I wanted to be a therapist. Definitely not the avenue I'm taking now. But in college, I finally sought therapy by myself, searched for everything on my own, found a lady, wasn't a good fit, but I didn't know that. I've been in therapy off and on for like 10 years-ish. Some of that is due to moving. Even before my husband joined the Air Force, we moved around. So I've been through more therapists than I can count. I'm trying to find... Oh, college is where I became anorexic and I started cutting. Nothing ever like serious that I need to go get stitches or go to the hospital. It was more or less an outlet or a way to feel something. So I used it for several things. I was diagnosed with PTSD, anxiety, and depression. I have nightmares. I have, you know, the whole nine yards. I have been hospitalized 3 or 4 times. None of those were a pleasant experience. People are they're not nice. Not to where I've been. I have never been anywhere where anybody was nice to me. So those were wonderful. Let's see. So some of this just is kind of just background, doesn't have to do with the abuse per se. I met my husband through Facebook. I know. We're going to make up this elaborate story for our kids. Super romantic.
Yes.
But it was through Facebook. But we had our first date, and we have been together ever since. We got married in 2013. We had our son in July of 2014. I finished college December of 2014, so few months after he was born, got my bachelor's degree. In March of 2015, he joined the Air Force. And then we had a little girl in November of 2016. She's a hot mess, y'all. I wanted a girl, but whoo, she's a hot mess. So honestly, it wasn't until we were in Missouri that I really got serious. I thought I was doing all the right things in therapy. But it wasn't until I got to Missouri and she really started to point things out and, you know, the lack of support from my mom, and my mom's a narcissist, by the way. So I really started kind of trying to dig into some of that. So previous years, I was not able to talk about what happened to me. Like, I could do very surface-level things, but after that, I couldn't give you anything. I was able to kind of start opening up with her. We had my husband in for sessions, my mom in for sessions. You know, my mom, in 2018, my mom finally apologized to me for the way she handled things. And a couple months later, she ended up separating from her husband and moving in with us because Annie, way too nice. I was about 27 when I truly started intense therapy and actually, like, talking about life. I would say I met my therapist about... Go ahead.
What I was going to say is you're very young. A lot of people don't start therapy or anything else like that well into their 30s or 40s or 50s, maybe even a little bit later. So I'm so thankful that you had, you know, the sensibility about you that, you know, it's good to talk. Talk therapy is very good, especially if you have the right therapist, okay? And, of course, they have to know about child abuse. So that's wonderful that you did that on your own because now you're, you know, a little bit older, not much. You're still a kid as far as I'm concerned, but anyway, the point is.
Thank you.
The point is that you're on your healing journey, and you know what?
everything that you do for yourself, I know that you tried EDM, well, I can't say it, EDNR, whatever it is. And I've heard good things. I've heard not so good things about that. Some people love it. Other people don't love it. If it works, it works. Whatever it is, whatever it takes, you know, for people to heal. And you're well on your way, and you had quite a time there, you know. You really did. Quite a time. And still you have your head together. And I'm really very proud of you. I really am. And I just love it when, you know, younger people come to NASCA, because we need to have the young blood, okay? We need to have that young blood. So, you know, whenever you feel like, you know, coming to the show, I certainly want you to, you know, feel comfortable. You're comfortable now. I can tell you, by the time the show is completely over, and it's almost, it'll be there coming up soon, you're going to feel really good about yourself. And I can see you're starting to now, because you're opening up. And the more you talk about these awful things that we go through as children, the less we feel it. We become, I'm not going to say we well, it is sort of like desensitizing. It does do that the more we speak about it, and we can handle it better, and then we can help others, and that's a wonderful thing. And you see, it's the survivors that help other people who have been through what we've gone through, whether you're degreed or not degreed or whatever. So it's, you know, you're doing a good thing just by starting this tonight. And again, I'm proud of you. So
thank you.
Go ahead. Yeah, you bet. And so go ahead and where you, from where you let off, and let's hear some more about what you're with your college and a lot of the stuff you were talking about. Go ahead.
Before I come more now into, since we've moved to Florida, we've been in Florida about a year and a half. So before I go into that, I want to backtrack for a second and say that when I still lived in Missouri, my husband was stationed at Whiteman Air Force Base for like 3.5 years. I could not really speak at all about anything. I could write things. So I started writing letters. I wrote a letter to Oprah, which she probably never got. She doesn't have a show anymore. But I wrote it and I sent it. I wrote a letter to, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Law & Order SVU. I'm obsessed with Olivia Benson. So I wrote a letter to Marichka. I've never heard anything back from any of this. But my whole goal was, I had realized after working for the system how bad they failed me. And I was just, my goal was to enact some sort of change at some point in the future for people like me that kind of fall through the cracks of the system. I wrote to some senators, sent some letters out to them. I wrote a letter to, you are probably familiar with the USA Gymnastics scandal with Larry Nassar. I read a book by Rachel Denhollander about her experience with Larry and going to court and all of that. I wrote her a letter. Like I said, I wanted to reach people that had connections, so that maybe we could talk about how to make change happen. Because for me, like, I thought my door was closed, you know. I was like, he's never going to suffer any consequences for his actions. So even in college, you know, my mom would invite him home for the weekend or, you know, for whatever. And I would sleep, he would sleep in the room next to me. She never asked me if I was okay with it, never said, hey, do you want to go stay with a friend? So I slept with pepper spray and a pocket knife under my pillow because I'm terrified of him, like, obviously. So mom just, that whole situation just kind of went on for a while. And then I will say I did start a little bit of EMDR in Missouri, and it was very different than what I'm doing now. I think it's different depending on your therapist. So when I moved here, it took me a while to want to find another therapist and kind of start over. It's a super, super hard process. And I was to the point where I was like, I've been doing this for a long time, guys. I'm still, like, in the same place. I don't feel like anything is changing. So it took me a while to find someone, but I met my current therapist, amazing, amazing woman, very skilled in EMDR and trauma. I pretty much trust everything she says. She's pretty amazing. So we've been working together for roughly a year. We started talking about things and doing a timeline, and typically you always do a timeline so they can kind of understand what was happening when. And we discovered through things, and I asked for my records from DCS, we kind of discovered that nothing was ever reported to the police. So, we discussed it, and I decided, you know what, I want to at least get something out there. I want, that way if somebody in the future were to ever come forward, there would be something behind that that they could look at instead of just one person coming up and saying something. There would be something else on the record. My other was, he also has three kids, and right now he has a 9-year-old daughter. She scares the crap out of me. So I also wanted somebody to go out and check on these kids and at least talk with them. There's only so much you can do as a worker. You can't make them tell you what's happening if something is happening. But those were my goals. It ended up going to the police in Indiana, and they called me one day and they said, "Well, Miss, like there's enough here that we're going to open an investigation." So this was September, October of last year, and I was like, "What do you mean you're going to open an investigation? Like statute of limitations is passed? Well, I don't understand what you're talking about." Statute of limitations, I technically had met because I told at 17. And nobody did anything, including my parents. So they started an investigation. So I spent the 7 or 8 months talking with them and trying to give them everything that I could so that they could make a case. You know, and my detective was amazing, very understanding gentleman in the state of Indiana. So we had two or three recorded phone interviews. Those were pretty freaking tough. Things that I had never shared with anybody, including my current therapist. I gave that stuff to him in hope that something would happen. But there was a lot of back and forth about whether the prosecutor would take my case. I was told that he would only take it if he was almost 100% certain that they could win. Which for me, the issue is there's no other witnesses. There's nobody else. Like, it's just me. So it's kind of a he said, she said thing. And proving that, especially as old as this case is, was going to be difficult. This was a long, long process. In December of last year, I was extremely overwhelmed with that process and just life and therapy, and I was very suicidal. I was cutting again. My therapist set up a safety plan with my husband that night and allowed me to go home. But I had to attend a partial hospitalization program. So that was attending a program from like 8 o'clock to 1 o'clock or 1:30 or whatever. 3 days a week. And I was pretty pissed about it, I'll just be honest, because I had kind of participated in one in college, and it was terrible. I had a very bad experience. I was not looking forward to this, but I didn't really have a choice. So I went, and eventually I asked to bump up to 5 days a week and was able to share things with a group of people. I don't talk to guys. Like, guys don't hear my story. Guys just don't have that privilege. I've been burned a lot in the past, not only by my brother, by my uncle, by a cousin, by a friend's brother. Guys have not been good to me. So to talk about my story at all in any way, shape, or form, first of all, to more than one person, but then to a group, was definitely challenging, but I think that it was vital. So I graduated from the program. Still continued with the back and forth on the case and the giving them more information. I read a flashback that I had written down. We had all this stuff for this case. And then June 3rd, so like I would say a week or two before, my dad told me that he was getting married. Super excited. I've wanted my dad to find someone for a very long time. And he's like, okay, the wedding is June 3rd. I invited your brother, too. And I'm like, oh, God, seriously? And he's like, yeah, your brother's going to be here. So my excitement was gone. And I had to tell him that I've learned to stand up for myself very recently as well. Definitely still a work in progress, but I'm getting there. I had to tell my dad that I would not be present at his wedding because my brother was going to be there. So he arranged for me to go, like, the week before and meet her and, you know, spend time. So because I was in Indiana, I was able to go meet my detective in person. I did a little short video interview, showed him some places that we had lived growing up. We worked on a timeline. We got everything ready. And he told me, he said, you know, next week your brother's going to be here. He has agreed to come in for an interview. This was his second interview, mind you. He had one in Washington in February. Didn't admit to much, but didn't really deny anything. Told me he was going to be in for that, and he said there was all these options. So if he didn't confess, the next option was they were going to offer a polygraph. So it comes down to it. He goes in 2 days before my dad's wedding, goes in, does the interview, and everything was, nope, didn't happen, nope, she's lying, blah, blah, blah. So they offer him the polygraph. He goes in the next day, and he passes the polygraph. So I'm waiting all freaking day to hear from my detective, and I finally get a hold of him right before I left my counselor's office, and he says, hey, I hate to tell you that he passed his polygraph. And I was devastated. It was exactly what I was afraid of happening, because he had told me that if he passed, my case was screwed, which is exactly what happened. The prosecutor refused to proceed, even though I wanted to. I was like, I'll take a polygraph. I can pass. And then they have no leverage. But they dropped the investigation. I mean, it's on paper now, you know, that I did all of that, but unfortunately, he gets to walk away and live his life just like he was
before.
I'm
sorry. Yeah, I'm really, really, really sorry.
Yep.
You know, sometimes people, just by their own breathing and they think ahead of time how they would, you know, they can actually do that. It's hard, but they can actually pass when they're guilty. It can happen.
Well,
and
he's lying to himself.
Well, you know, I mean, I believe you. I know what you're saying is true. But unfortunately, with the polygraph, they don't really use that in a court of law, from what I understand. The judge takes it back into the chambers, and he listens, and maybe the prosecutor and also attorneys. But on the other hand, I am so sorry, you know, that you had to go through that. I'm sorry that you had to go through the whole blasted thing, you know. And
I was pretty upset. I felt like I wasted my time. And I'm still working on accepting the fact that they gave me this hope that he might have to suffer some consequences, and then they took it away. Sorry, this is pretty fresh.
You know what? Let me say something to you about that, because I had a friend that she and I worked together at the same methadone clinic, and we were counselors there. But she was given truth serum, okay? And whatever, you know, happened to her came out. So it's just something to keep in mind. It worked with her, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know, ask someone about it. Because this is, upsetting. Because some people just do know how to pass these tests. They just know how to do it. So if you, on the other hand, you know, were able to, I'm not telling you to do it. I'm just giving you an option. Because I saw it work.
Yeah.
I had to take her there, okay, and she'd get the truth serum. Because you get very, very groggy, so she didn't have to drive back and forth. So, but anyway, it's a thought. I don't know. Go ahead.
I'm still working on that. It's been a tough one. But through all of it, you know, I was able to set some boundaries with my mom. I told her she needed to move out. She lived with us for 3.5 years, and she's a narcissist, on his kind of on his side about everything. It was a big mess, but I finally was able to start talking to her and telling her, like, I'm not going to take the blame that you put on me anymore. If you have an issue, talk to your son. So she moved out in June, which was amazing, guys. Like, I just can't even. It was amazing. And we're kind of starting to pick up back on EMDR. So I'll talk about that for just a second. It's brutal, and it's terrible. But I think that it can help. I have seen a couple shifts, and one of the biggest for me is the guilt. I lived with guilt that didn't belong to me up until now, you know, this whole time since I was 7 years old. But really learning to see him for who he truly is and how none of it was my fault. I definitely think that it has worked for that. So we're just about to move to the tough stuff and really go through that. But the way she does it is she will ask me to bring up the memory and how it makes me feel. And then I close my eyes because that's what works best for me. And I really bring it up and think about it. And then she'll ask me, you know, like, what are you noticing? What do you see? But at that point, you can kind of talk about anything. For me, it's talking about the details of what happened. And kind of bringing those to the surface. It's vital for me. Not everybody has to do that, but I know that I have to. You know, and then it's about 40, 45 minutes of this going back and forth. And once, you know, she'll find something and she'll say, oh, okay, go with that. And then she'll take her fingers, and you watch her fingers, and they go back and forth. Some people use what's called a light bar. Other people have buzzers that you hold in your hand, and they, you know, it'll buzz in your right hand and then your left, and it goes back and forth. It's all about the bilateral stimulation, because that keeps your rational, your thinking brain online. Because with trauma, it completely shuts down. So the whole goal is to reprocess with your thinking brain online. And it's terrible. I would much rather, people say surviving the abuse is the worst part, and I 100% do not agree. I think trying to deal with that later is way worse. Just from a personal perspective, not everybody will agree. So we are working on that right now. It's tough. I feel like that's where my hope is at. I've tried talk therapy, and I need something else. I will say, when I was in college, I did write a letter to my brother, kind of calling him out. You know, I've since had conversations with my mom about don't speak to me about him, and laying, you know, like, if you do, X, Y, and Z is going to happen, like, just so you know. I'm coming to a lot of harsh realizations about the people that my parents are. My mom is actually out visiting him as we speak, which is a tough one for me as well. She's visiting my rapist, you know, like, that's just a tough one. So we are just, that's a whole rocky situation, but I am.
It's very difficult, you know, it is very difficult. You know, like, I was in the same spot with my brother that you are, not quite the same things happened, but my mother didn't care. Okay, she didn't care. I told her, and she didn't care. At a very early age, I told her, because it started at 9, and I had just gotten kidnapped and raped in New York, and what I needed was a good brother. But instead, he started in, okay? Oh, boy. So I have a big mouth, all right? So I told her, and she said, oh, things like this happen in families, and that was the end of that. Okay. So I had to go through it for years off and on with him. And you spoke earlier about this maniacal look. And yes, I know what that maniacal look is, because he would get that maniacal look on his face. And it was very intimidating, I must say, you know? So, but when your mother doesn't listen to you and you have a maniacal acting brother, you don't want to see them on holidays. You don't want to certainly go to, like you said, a wedding, you know it was your father, and you wanted him to get remarried. You want him to be happy. I understand that. I get it. We all get it. Because a lot of us have been put in positions where maybe it wasn't the brother, maybe it was the uncle, maybe it was a cousin, or maybe, you know, someone. It's so much in the family is the point that I'm trying to make. And then you have these family functions, and who wants to look at these people? I don't. I get it. Okay, go ahead.
Exactly.
Ay, ay, ay.
Well, but we're just expected to, you know, and I did for years. But through this therapist and her encouragement, and like I said, I have a very supportive husband. I have actually offered him an out of our marriage, a lot, because I know that what I go through is extremely difficult, and I know it takes a toll on him, and it's hard for him to watch and to participate in. Like, I know it's hard. You know, so I told him, like, if you need to go, that's okay. Like, I will understand. I'm not going to be angry. I'll probably be upset, you know, and sad, but I'm not going to be angry with you. If that's what you need to do, then, of course. And he's like, babe, had this discussion, I don't know how many times. I'm not going anywhere. I mean, he's really seen the worst, me at my worst. So for him to still be here, I feel like kind of speaks volumes about him in that sense. But he's been wonderful, and he's normally not a patient person, but with this, he's being very patient. We just took intercourse off the table, y'all. Like, and he's willing to number one supporter. So I've been able to get out underneath my mom. I actually have started a book. Don't know where it'll go. Hopefully one day it'll go out there. I still would like at some point to find some sort of connection to figure out how we can make things better for kids in the future who come forward. Like, I just, something has to give somewhere, whether it be with the workers that are hired or, I don't know, the laws that are in place. Because right now in the state of Indiana, when we were looking at charging him, they could only prosecute for anything that happened after when he was 16 or older, which only left a year. That was only a year of what happened to me that we could prosecute. We could have used everything else in court to build, you know, patterns of behavior and blah, blah, blah. But when it came down to sentencing, it was only for that year of time, because that's how the law is in Indiana right now. I haven't asked. I need to ask. He had told me that the prosecutor was actually fighting to have that changed because of my case, and to remove statute of limitations. So there was some things that they were trying to do. I don't know what that looks like now. Because it doesn't matter if he was 16 or not, it was still rape. But they call it...
That's right.
They say I was molested. And being molested and being raped are different. They are not the same thing. So I'm kind of...
I think it can do the same damage, though. Let me just say that.
I agree.
I want to clarify something with that, you know. Because people, I think they look at molestation... they don't look at it as being as significant by law. They don't. But let me tell you something. You get molested a lot. I mean, and I was. I had both from my brother. It was, you know, the intercourse, if you want to call it that, and molestation. And one to me was just as frightening and nasty as the other. And I had an uncle that would mount me and get on top of me, and he couldn't enter me. I was too young. My abuse started when I was six. And to me, that was horrifying. To me, that's rape. Sorry.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So, go ahead.
Well,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think it's important to say that it only takes one. It doesn't have to be, I guess I don't want anybody to feel like, oh, well, hers was worse or whatever, so mine doesn't matter. Because it only takes one time. It only takes that 15 seconds or that 3 hours, whatever it was. That's all it takes, and it completely changes the course of your life. I mean, it alters everything. There is not a facet
you
of
bet.
My life that it has touched. So, I don't want to say that molestation is lesser in a sense, because I think, like you said, it does. It can do exactly the same damage. It is a big deal.
Yeah.
There is a difference between them, though, and the way that they can charge them in the court of law.
Right.
That, I guess that's all I'm saying with that. I don't want anybody to think anything that theirs is, there doesn't matter, they're inferior in any way, because that's not true.
Yeah. No,
you're allowed
isn't.
To have
no.
your feelings about it.
Mm-hmm.
So now I just,
well, you know,
I'm really thinking.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just letting you know we're coming to the end of the show. You see how fast that went? Do you
sure
see?
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
We still have a few minutes left. Go ahead. Finish your thought. Go ahead.
I mean, right now in life, I have my struggles. EMDR sucks. I work a part-time job. I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old and trying to be mom and wife and a good employee, and it's a lot to balance sometimes, but I'm really learning the art of self-care. I always thought I was doing it, but I really wasn't, and so I've really learned what that means, you know, and being able to ask for those things or to just say, sometimes with my husband, I will straight up just be like, babe, I need to go out and work in the garden, or I need you to take care of the kids tonight because I can't parent. Learning what to ask for and when to ask for it and being brave enough to say it, but learning just to take care of me. I still have a hard time, but I'm doing it.
You're doing a fine job. You're doing a fine job, I'm telling you right now. After what you've been through for all those years, you know, and only having a couple of people in your corner and your family and all this other stuff, or maybe a few, whatever. The point is, you're doing a fine job, and you have vision, okay? You're not stuck. You have vision. In time, you want to try and get out there, you know, and help other people. And I honestly believe it's the survivors, you know, okay, that are going to help those that are just starting the healing journey, as we call it right here. On NASCAR. And believe me, there's a place for you. If you want to come on and observe some more shows, if you want to volunteer, that's fine. I'm so thankful that, you know, that you showed up tonight. And I understood where your predicament. I understood what you're saying there earlier. Your husband might be going away. Maybe tonight. I don't know. But, you know.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. But, you know, that's fine. You know, you've got a head on your shoulders, honey. You're not stupid, okay? And you're going to be able to move forward. Yeah, it's true. It's true. And you know that it was never your fault, okay? And as far as the shame and the blame, it has to be put on the right proper person, and that was your brother. And shame a little bit on your mother because she didn't listen to you, okay? So never, ever, ever, ever think that it was your fault, ever. At any time. Okay, we just got the 90-second cue, okay? So I have to, like, end the show. And I just want to say to you, keep going along. You're doing fine. You're doing the right things. And you can always come to us. You can always call us. You can even go to the contact list if you want to speak to someone. You want to speak to John. You want to speak to me. I don't care. We're there. And whomever, or Darlene, or whomever, or Bill, anyone, we're right here for you. And you are a member now of NASCAR. And you can come on same time, Monday through Friday, okay? Any day you want, okay?
Okay. Awesome.
And,
I appreciate that.
Yeah. And you're a part of the family. That's what you are. So, you know, come on when you want, okay? I have to end the show
Thank
now.
You
did a fine job, and good for you. I'm
Thank
proud.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
I appreciate you guys having me.
Oh, well, okay. You can come back now.
Good night,
okay?
Thank you
yeah,
so much.
Good night.
Okay.
Yeah, you bet.
Good night. Thank
good
you.
Night, honey. Good
job.
Night, honey.
Great job.
Thank you.
Yeah, great job. Good night.
After all that you've done.